Well, I'm not willing to say that there wasn't any news from the world of collecting this week. And by the way, welcome to the Collector's Show. I'm your host, Harold Nickel, here on Web Talk Radio. Thanks for joining us. And what I started to say was that I'm not really ready to say that there wasn't any news from the world of collecting this week, but what I am going to say is that we're going to skip the news segment of the show to give more time for our two guests. In the first interview segment of the program, Daniel Piazza is going to take stamp collecting to levels that you just can't imagine, and then we'll be joined by our regular contributor, Lawrence C. Zale, who will tell us about what to look for and how to know if what it is that you're buying really is worthwhile as a collectible, not just as something that you fall in love with or think that you can't live without, but has the potential to be meaningful. So please enjoy these next two segments, A World of Stamp Collecting and Its Relationship to History, along with how to know if what you are purchasing is really something that you want to add to your collection. Here on Web Talk Radio, I'm Harold Nickel, and it is The Collector's Show. Welcome to the interview portion of The Collector's Show. You know, a lot of people over the years have collected stamps, but very, very few have taken it to the level of expertise that our guest today has. Daniel A. Piazza is the assistant curator of Filatelli at the Smithsonian National Postal Museum. He collects and writes about stamps and postal history with a particular expertise during what he refers to as the Bureau period, which was 1894 to 1978. And he also has some expertise that relates to Italy and the Italian peninsula. He sits on the board of governors of the Vatican Philatelic Society and edits its journal, Vatican Notes. He's also received the Society's Veritas and President's Awards for scholarship and service, respectively. His other national memberships include the American Philatelic Society, American Philatelic Research Library, American First Day Cover Society, and Writers Unit Number 30. Here on the East Coast in the D.C. area, he serves as literature chairman for the NAPEX exhibition and belongs to both the Washington Stamp Collectors Club and the Baltimore Philatelic Society. In addition to his philatelic activities, Piazza is an academic historian specializing in U.S. history to 1760. He holds degrees in the subject of stamp collecting from Wagner College and Syracuse University, and has completed his coursework for a doctorate. Daniel, welcome to the Collector Show.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for inviting me.
Before we get too much into the interview, I got to ask you, how did you become associated with the Vatican, and why is the Catholic Church interested in stamps and stamp collecting?
Well, I'm not really associated with the Vatican, but with a group of people who collect the postage stamps of the Vatican. And for me, it's really part of a larger interest in the stamps and the postal history of the Italian peninsula. And that interest really comes from my own ancestral heritage, which is actually a way a lot of people get into stamps and stamp collecting. It's collecting the stamps and mail from the country that their ancestors came from.
Yeah, that's awesome, and I want to get further into that. But a lot of people, including me, until I actually had a chance to go there, don't really realize that Vatican City is a country.
Right. And yeah, Vatican City is a country, and as a country, it operates its own postal system, and a postal system that's independent of the Italian postal system. And so the postage stamps that they issue, although many of them are sold to collectors around the world who are interested in owning Vatican stamps and collecting Vatican stamps, they are actually used on mail that originates in the Vatican.
Okay. See, we learn something new here all the time. I had no idea.
Sure.
And we'll get into more about heritage as we go through. And if you're just tuning in, it's The Collector Show with Harold Nickel. And today we're talking about stamps and stamp collecting with Daniel Piazza. And I hope I'm saying your last name correctly.
You are, yeah, perfectly.
All right. So you've made and have had a very remarkable career in this field. When did you first get interested in stamps?
Yeah, I don't really remember what age, but I was very young. I mean, let's say single digits.
Okay.
Certainly, maybe 7 or 8. And someone bought me a beginner's kit and an album in the gift shop of a museum. And it really just sort of took off from there. I suppose what attracted me to it, the reason I was interested in it, was the whole idea of organizing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, taking a big packet of stamps and making sense out of it. You know, sorting it and putting everything in its place where it belonged. That was an attractive hobby for me. And I guess also what attracted me to it was that it felt like, as a young kid, it felt like I was doing something, you know, very, very grown up. There were lots of other things one could have collected at that age, Pokemon cards and all of these sorts of things. But stamps somehow, in terms of supporting this gallery and donating to it and publicizing it in philatelic journals and magazines, that sort of thing. So there's a lot of excitement and buzz around it right now. And I think it's going to be a tremendous success.
So for those of you who are time-shifting, the next 7 or 8 weeks are going to be October of 2013. Is that right?
September 22nd, we open to the public.
Okay, so for those of you who are time-shifting, and everybody that listens to this program is, September the 22nd, 2013. And finally, Daniel, how can people get in touch with you or the museum? What's the best way to do that?
Well, the museum has two websites. Our main website, which is about our exhibits and really geared for planning your visit to the museum, is postalmuseum.si.edu.
Okay.
And then we have a separate website, which really has more of our collections. It's like a collections database website. And that's called Arago, arago.si.edu.
Okay.
And then to reach me personally, my email address is my last name, Piazza, P-I-A-Z-Z-A, and my first initial D, as in Daniel, at si.edu.
And what we'll do, listeners, is we'll post all of that information on the show page. Daniel, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Your perspective, experience, and education have been really enlightening, and I hope that after the new part of the museum opens and you get your feet on the ground, you'll come back and talk to us about that.
Great chatting with you. I'd love to do it.
Stay tuned. More to come on The Collector's Show with Harold Nickel right here on Web Talk Radio.
Appealed to me in a different way.
So it was bringing order to chaos that
right.
helped get you started.
Right.
And I can imagine that for somebody who's 7 or 8, that it would feel very adult-like to be adding or bringing order to chaos. But for myself, who frankly doesn't know a whole lot about collecting stamps, when you said going through them and organizing them, what kind of organization are we talking about?
Well, at the time, it was mostly, you know, organizing them by country, which can be challenging. You know, you buy these worldwide packets as a kid, and they might have 100 or 200 stamps from all over the world, and they're in all sorts of different languages and different colors and different currencies. And for a young kid, it's a real challenge. It can take hours to sort a packet of 200 stamps, you know, with a little book that helps you, like a concordance, you know, that helps you match up the language with the country and that sort of thing. You know, now it would be very easy to do, but as a kid, it took a long time, and you were learning as you did it.
Yes, organizational skills, and it seems like it would also take a lot of just stick-to-itiveness to be able to stay with a project like that, particularly
sure.
if you're elementary school-aged.
Sure, and besides organizational skills, language and geography and, you know, those sorts of things.
So you got quite an education about history, geography. What about art? Did you learn about art and design from your stamp collecting?
I think so. Maybe a little subconsciously. I don't think as a kid I was really sort of analyzing the different art styles. Certainly looking at stamps from around the world now, I can see that now. Maybe not so much as a kid.
Now, even I'm not old enough to remember the days before the telephone, never mind the telegraph. But I'm not sure that people really understand or realize how significant letters and written correspondence were before we had electronic communications. Can you help us wrap our heads around how vital that was?
Well, I mean, never mind even before telegraph or the telephone. I mean, it's even getting hard to remember before the internet, at this point. And I think you're right. Most people don't grasp the importance of the postal system in those terms. I think the image in popular culture today of the postal system is that it's somewhat irrelevant. You know, and we all read in the news about the financial crisis that not just our postal service, but postal services around the world are experiencing. Everything's online, and people say, well, who needs a postal service anymore when you go online and do all of your business and buy what you need? But, you know, all that stuff you buy on eBay or Amazon.com or whatever, it all has to get delivered somehow. And even if you think your mail is being delivered, say, well, I don't need the postal service because it's being shipped FedEx or UPS or one of these other couriers, even if you think your mail is coming through one of those couriers, chances are at least somewhere along the line it's making use of the postal network and postal system. So I think the postal system is relevant. I think it's vital. I think it's necessary. But people don't necessarily see it that way.
And as you say, those commercial carriers are leveraging the postal service and their network, and I hope they're getting paid. I'm a marketing advertising guy, and if it were up to me, I would take what you just suggested and reposition the postal service instead of letter carriers as package delivery, and emphasize the price advantages compared to those commercial systems.
Sure, and they're already doing that. A lot of what's referred to in the package industry as the last mile is a lot of that is for both UPS, FedEx is covered by the Postal Service.
That last mile slogan, that's brilliant. That's the first I've ever heard that. That's really good positioning.
Yeah.
So from a historical point of view, Benjamin Franklin was the very first postmaster of the United States. And Franklin was extremely famous in his time as an inventor, scientist, and statesman. And it was just my opinion, but it looked to me and seemed to me that a man of his stature appointed to the role of postmaster really spoke to the importance of the postal system in those days. And I was curious what you thought about that.
Well, I think that's right. And, you know, Franklin was actually Postmaster General under two governments. He was the Postmaster General for the British Crown, even before the American Revolution. Actually, the vast majority of his association or his career in the postal system was under the Crown Post Office in the colonies. He was 37 years a postmaster.
Wow.
And 21 of those as postmaster general for all the colonies. Before that, he was the postmaster of Philadelphia. And so, actually, he was only postmaster general of the United States under the Articles of Confederation government for a little over a year. So the vast majority of his career actually was under the Royal Mail. But we remember him, obviously, as being the first Postmaster General of the United States. And you're right. I mean, in his lifetime, he was second only to Washington as the most famous American. And overseas, he was probably even more famous than he was at home. Overseas, probably more people knew the name Franklin than Washington.
Likely so. And he was also, I think, ambassador to France and like you say, really well known and widely respected.
Right.
So I kind of gave away my age when I talked about before the telephone and telegraph, and you indicated before the internet. But let's dial it back even further in time. And if you're able to give us some examples about the first time or first instances where somebody or something charged to carry a piece of written correspondence from one place to the next.
Well, I think we would trace most modern postal systems to back around the 13th century, when governments and large institutions like the church and universities in Europe employed couriers to carry their mail.
Mm-hmm.
And gradually over time, at different points in time in different countries, those closed systems, either run by the crown or the church or a university, gradually opened up to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And started to take public mail for a fee. So before the invention of postage stamps, there was mail, people could put mail into the postal system, and fees were assessed and charged and collected by writing on the face of the letter the amount of money to be paid.
Oh.
And that amount of money was usually charged to the recipient. The sender didn't necessarily pay for the letter, but the person who received the letter paid to collect it.
Mm.
And as you can imagine, what that led to over time was a lot of unpaid mail.
I was just thinking that.
Right.
Hey, I didn't ask for this.
That's right.
And no, you can't have any money.
Right, and particularly, you know, if you're writing to me and I don't like you very much, or I owe you money and I know that you're just writing to me to collect money or something like that, well, I'm certainly not going to pay to receive the letter.
Right.
And so a lot of what we call dead letters or dead mail was piling up. And so the idea for postage stamps, that is that the sender would prepay the postage on the mail and indicate that they had prepaid that postage by using one of these labels or stamps on a letter, really originates in England in the late 1830s. And it's in England that the first postage stamp is issued, a stamp we call the penny black, in 1840. And that practice then gradually spreads throughout the world. The first stamps in our hemisphere are actually not issued by the United States, but they're issued by Brazil.
Hmm.
The United States was actually, in the scheme of things, relatively late in issuing postage stamps. The first U.S. stamps were issued in 1847. But prepaying the mail and using those postage stamps was still optional. It wasn't mandatory.
But 1847 is pretty late.
Right.
That's a surprise. I'm struck by that. That's, well, it's not lately, but I would have thought it would have been the 1700s anyway.
Right. No, not postage stamps. You know, as I say, there was mail in the 1700s. You could send a letter, and it was collected through these accountancy markings on the fronts of letters. But postage stamps themselves in the U.S. are issued in 1847.
Now, if we come visit you guys at the National Postal Museum in Washington, D.C., would we be able to see one of those original stamps?
The penny black and the first U.S. postage stamps.
Yes.
And a number of the worldwide postage stamps that were issued in between the penny black and the first U.S. stamps, yes.
That's amazing. Amazing. And probably one of just a lot of reasons to come and see you guys in D.C.
I think so, yeah.
So let's switch gears and let's talk about some of the clubs and societies that you're active with. You're involved with the Washington Stamp Collectors Club and the Baltimore Philatelic Society. What's the value of these particular clubs and clubs like these, and especially for the novice collector?
Well, I think a lot of people start out collecting as what we sometimes call lone wolves. You know, these are folks who collect stamps on their own. Maybe they do a lot of their buying from mail order catalogs or the internet, and they collect on their own at home and never really join clubs like the Washington Stamp Collectors Club and so forth. And a number of people remain lone wolf collectors through their whole collecting career, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what clubs offer are a few things. most clubs will hold auctions for their members and trading sessions among their members. So it's a good, inexpensive source of stamps for your collection is, you know, buying and trading directly from other collectors. But beyond sharing and trading stamps and covers themselves, it's sharing and trading the knowledge about them. You know, you can really learn a lot from fellow members in stamp clubs, and sometimes you're lucky enough to find a mentor who really helps you in your hobby. And there's a social side to the hobby then as well. You know, it becomes not just about amassing and accumulating and collecting, but you start collecting friends and mentors and other people who have similar interests to you, as well as collecting the little bits of paper.
Well, I think that's so well said, that the social aspect of this or any kind of collection where you have a chance to gather with like-minded people is extremely important.
And I think so. I think folks who aren't doing that are missing a big part of the collecting experience and why collecting anything, whether it's stamps or coins or whatever else. Why it can be so rewarding is those personal connections that you make as well.
If you're just joining us, it's the Collector's Show with Harold Nickel, talking today with Daniel Piazza of the National Postal Museum, part of the Smithsonian Institute. Now, Daniel, if I were going to start collecting stamps today, what are some of the first things I should think about?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is, you know, don't worry about folks who tell you must collect this, or this area is hot, this is the popular area, this is the only thing to collect. Don't worry too much about that. I think you start out by collecting something that interests you. And that can be, as I said at the beginning, one way that people get into stamp collecting is, you know, if your ancestors came from Italy or Ireland or West Africa or Japan, you know, you can collect the stamps of the country that your ancestors came from.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can collect the stamps of places that you've traveled to or that you'd like to travel to. A lot of people will collect stamps and mail related to their occupation or their job. And so one of my personal collections, not that I do on behalf of the museum, but my own little personal collection, is stamps and mail related to the Smithsonian Institution. So people who are lawyers will collect lawyers on stamps, or doctors will collect doctors on stamps, that sort of thing. So find a subject that interests you. Subject-based collecting is probably one of the biggest entries into the stamp collecting field, what we call topical collecting.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be almost anything: flowers, holidays, animals, states, countries, anything.
And along those lines, if you had picked a topic that you were interested in, space travel or
mm-hmm.
art, like you said, or geography, is it possible for the average working person to assemble a collection that's meaningful or valuable or both?
I think so. I mean, I consider myself an average working person, and it's all in how you define meaningful and valuable, really. You can define those words lots of different ways. So it can be meaningful to you personally.
Mm-hmm.
It can be valuable as a historic artifact. You know, it can have historical value, even though it might not necessarily be the most expensive stamp or cover on the market. I mean, I'll never own personally any of the world's great rarities, but that's not the point of collecting, I don't think.
Yeah, I agree with you. In my personal collections, I don't think that there's ever been anything I collected that had any kind of substantial monetary value.
Mm-hmm.
But I collected them because they were meaningful to me or reminded me of something when I was growing up, or a special occasion or things like that. And
sure,
by and large, the people that we talk to on this program, those are the things that they say. I never expect to make any money from my collection. I do it for reasons that have absolutely nothing to do with getting rich.
Right. And so the bottom line is, you set a budget for yourself, whatever that budget is, however modest or extravagant, you know,
yeah.
You can afford to make your budget. And then you go to some clubs and you go to some shows, and you'll find dealers and other collectors who will have material in all sorts of price ranges. And no matter what your budget or your price range is, you'll be able to do something, I think, very rewarding and very interesting. And, you know, if you want to see the great rarities and famous and legendary stamps, well, then that's what the Postal Museum's for. And you come to Washington and you go to the Smithsonian and you see the world's great stamps, where they're accessible to everybody in the brand-new William H. Gross Stamp Gallery that we're building to open next month here in Washington. And then you go home and have your own treasures of a different kind.
Well, you can certainly get photographs of yourself by those great rarities. But
right.
talk to us a little bit more about the new project that you guys have going at the museum.
Next month, we're opening the world's largest gallery of stamps and mail, over 10,000 square feet, including some of the great gems and rarities of the world, as well as more research-type collections, and U.S. and international as well. I think that when the public gets their first look at this gallery in about 7 or 8 weeks from now, it's going to be a big hit.
I certainly want to thank Daniel Piazza for being on the Collector's Show with us this week. And as that opening gets closer, we'll have more to say about that on the Collector's Show website and hopefully get him back to tell us more. Stay tuned for Larry Zale coming up next on the Collector's Show. Well, it's the part of the Collector's Show where we're very privileged to have Lawrence C. Zale, president of Lawrence C. Zale Associates Incorporated. Lawrence, or Larry, as he's nice enough to let us call him, is a visual arts advisory expert, and to say that he's an expert doesn't really do you justice, Larry, I don't think, and welcome back.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, Harold, and you're very kind.
Well, I have really learned a lot listening to you and talking with you over the last few weeks, and I know that the listeners have as well. And we're going to start a little bit more what I want to call a strategic approach and educating our listeners about not just having things or not just collecting things, but a more strategic approach to building a significant, meaningful, and possibly valuable collection. And so what I want to ask you about this week, Larry, is without respect to what type of object it is, what should the people in the audience look for in an object?
It's a good question and not easily answered because there are almost an infinity of choices of what to collect. But once a decision is made to collect something, collectors are confronted with two issues. It's been my experience to observe. The first would be to look at an object based upon its aesthetic merit. By that I mean looking at the object and saying, this really appeals to me right down to the marrow of my bones. And I'm not really thinking about the second choice or the second consideration, which would be its fair market value. Collectors invariably have collections that are quite beautiful, that appeal to them deep down inside, but have never given thought to its value. At the same time, there are others who didn't start off thinking that way either, but chose to collect because they felt that over a period of time the collection would increase in value. So you have these two issues at play.
So it sounds to me like there's the emotional component versus the rational component, and finding some kind of a way to negotiate those two is part of the challenge of what to look for. Is that a fair conclusion?
Yes.
So help us figure out, and I'll give an example from my own life. I've seen things in my collecting life that I fell in love with, okay? And it never occurred to me a single time that the object, the thing, and it was always, for me, it was always Christmas ornaments, but that it would have any kind of value other than the fact that, you know, I can't live another day without it. How do we negotiate those kinds of emotions versus the other things that are more rational about, does it fit in with a theme or does it potentially have some other value?
The passion, in my view, should be maintained, but put aside during a period when one is considering an acquisition. Otherwise, it will get in the way of sound judgment, as you suggest. Authenticity, which is to, broadly speaking, determine if the object is genuine or not. Was it created by the hands of the artist? That is important. So is the provenance, which is a fancy way of saying a record of ownership of the object.
Right.
And you know, with this record, you can track if the object, from its creation to the present, is sound. If there are gaps in the provenance, the collector should be aware of potential problems ahead.
So for me, who you know, provenance, another way maybe of expressing that is there a paper trail help you be as confident as you can be that what it is that you're looking at to buy is in fact genuine and not a forgery or a fake or a copy?
Right. And the paper trail that you allude to can be invoices, records of previous ownership that have been conveyed. Whatever information you may have will only add to the strength of your collection, because when there are doubts, it takes away from the integrity of the collection and ultimately its value.
Yeah, it's I don't think anybody wants to buy something for their collection where there's a hint of a doubt that, well, maybe it's not as advertised, maybe it's not an original. So for someone like me who doesn't have a lot of experience in this kind of record keeping or this kind of investigation, what would you, as an experienced individual in this field, what would you recommend?
Do as much research as you possibly can, Harold, to get information that will keep you informed. You may still want to buy that object or series of objects with these gaps because, as I mentioned earlier, they may appeal to you aesthetically. But if you really want to have a collection that is grounded with the information you'll need to make it strong and potentially valuable, not just to you and potentially heirs, but also others, you will need this information. And may I add, issues of quality, which brings often from experts to determine, you know, the object's value, and the condition is also very important. There are works that are quite beautiful, but if they're in bad condition, the value will suffer.
Yeah, that was the thing I was going to ask about next. You may have read my mind here. And, aesthetics is broad, but I know that in terms of the boxes that things come in or the condition of the paper, is it wrinkled, is it torn, does it have watermarks on it, those are literally, when we think about aesthetics, the way it looks, and it sounds to me like that's really important.
Yes. You may have, for example, a print in seemingly magnificent condition, great colors, but upon close inspection, especially on the reverse, there is foxing, which is a mold that has been created because of dampness attributed to various conditions will immediately take away from the value of the print. They may also find certain wrinkles or creases within the corners that upon immediate observation are not noticed. That will have a detrimental effect on the value of the print, but it may not take away one iota from the aesthetic appeal of the owner.
Yeah, and you know the kinds of things that you describe, Larry, in terms of wrinkles, mold, I've seen different things for sale that had, like, somebody had set their coffee cup on it and had a coffee ring on it. That can apply to everything from a baseball card to a comic book to an original work of art. So these are really good coaching, so to speak, for people who collect all different types of things. And I'm going to bet that if you looked at different kinds of three-dimensional things like ceramics or any kind of, well, I can't get another word other than dimensional, that something that you can hold in your hand, that if it's nicked or scratched or been glued back together, that that would also detract from its overall value.
Very much so. And there's one other consideration I would recommend that we add to our conversation this morning, and that is...
Okay.
If it is a most unusual piece, it will have a much higher value than if it is a piece.
Okay.
Or object.
So, in terms of rarity, and that kind of gets us back to the ownership and the paper trail, is it common for objects to be numbered?
If they're prints and drawings, yes. And typically, the numbers that are low in the total will have a better resolution than later prints. But if you don't have numbers to go from, and you're just going based upon a visual inspection, it would be very important to look very carefully before making a decision on the condition and the other issues that I had mentioned, including its rarity.
And Larry, as we get to the end of our segment this week, if people who are listening have questions about ownership, provenance, quality, those kinds of things, and they wanted to speak with you directly, can you tell us how they could reach you?
I certainly can. I can be reached at lczale@aol.com.
Okay, and that's just your initials and all. It's lczale@aol.com.
Lczale, right. And my company's website is visualartsadvisory.com.
All right. So for those of you listening who would like to explore individually with Larry different kinds of opportunities and whether or not a piece is not just appealing to you emotionally but actually has some other potential value and you want to talk to Larry directly, his email lczale@aol.com or his website visualartsadvisory.com. And Larry, as always, thank you so much for being with us here on the Collector Show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Harold.
Stay tuned for one final word. It's Web Talk Radio. Well, I hope you enjoyed this installment of the Collector's Show. Be sure to come back with us next week. We're going to learn about whatever happened to lunchbox art and collecting, and how did a comic book that was written back in the early 1990s turn out to be prophetic for its artist? You won't want to miss that. Come back for the Collector's Show next week here on Web Talk Radio. Bye for now.